Thank you very much, Dharma Charlene, for that very, very warm and generous and fulsome introduction. I always feel uneasy when you get a really good introduction. I knew Dharma Charlene would do a really good introduction, because if the talk really doesn't work out, what are we all, we're all going to go home very embarrassed, aren't we? But hopefully something will save me with you this evening. And I'm very conscious of the fact that I, as Dharma Charlene said, I spend most of my time in the marshlands of South Norfolk in a retreat centre, and most of the time I'm communicating the Dharma to men who have quite a bit of experience. I do visits to centres where there's people of all sorts of ranges of experience, different backgrounds, lifestyles and so on. In fact, I'm on a little bit of a tour at the moment. It's a bit of an accident, this tour, but I was at the London Buddhist Centre in Bethnal Green last Monday, doing a double act really with a very close order member friend of mine to help him launch a book that he's written. Is he coming here? Has he been here at Raguna? Maybe he'll come. Get in. He's good. So that was the sort of Dharma night. And then the following night I was in Brighton, giving a talk to, I get the impression, to a similar, range of people, from, you know, different levels of experience. That went well, I'm pleased to say. Yes, and now I'm in Birmingham. Very good to be in Birmingham. I haven't been to Birmingham for quite a long time. Very good to see the centre. And yes, the theme of this talk, the Buddha as the symbol of awakening. I think that's what it is. And I've been, you know, thinking a bit about this today. I tend not to write talks anymore. I used to write talks, but I just, something in me can't do it. I think it's partly because I want to be much more in communication and rapport with everybody I'm talking to, rather than staring at my notes with a kind of pre-script. It's very interesting. The Buddha himself had a very, very particular quality. He was a brilliant communicator. I mean, he could communicate with anybody, regardless of their backgrounds, their situations. And he also had a very particular quality when he gave a discourse, you know, to a large, you know, group of people. He could, the quality of his voice would fill the room, or the, well, it wouldn't be a room, it would usually be out in the open. It would fill the gathering, but it wouldn't go beyond it. So it was just the right pitch. It would be, the timbre of his voice would be really mellow and pleasing, sometimes quite strong. Sometimes it was said he'd have a lion's roar. Sometimes it was said he'd have the voice of a very, very high god-like being. He also had this amazing quality. Although he's talking to everybody, everybody feels that the talk is just for them personally. I think that'd be really handy to have that particular quality. So you're in a room, you know, and this is a fairly big gathering, not as big as the gatherings I've addressed in India, but wouldn't it be great if you, as well as talking to everybody collectively, you're actually talking to everybody individually, so that they are really feeling spoken to, really feeling communicated with, and that what's being said is for them. Well, you know, that's the quality of the Buddha, of the enlightened person. He's able to do that. This is quite interesting to start by talking about the Buddha's quality of communication, because I think if we think about the Buddha as the symbol of awakening, perhaps what comes to our mind is the Buddha image, particularly the Buddha seated in meditation with legs crossed, with the palms one on top of the other like this. This is probably the most ubiquitous Buddha image. I mean, and it's well known now in the West. this kind of Buddha image, or the other forms that we have here. These are well-known forms. I was thinking about encounters with the Buddha image and how ubiquitous it is. I mean, I was down staying with my sister when I was down in Brighton, because I come from down there, and my brother-in-law, who's not a Buddhist, he's not in anything. My sister's quite a devout Christian, although a very, you know, she's not at all unhappy about me being a Buddhist. She's rather proud of it, actually, and tells everybody in the village that what I am, great gusto. But her husband, he just likes Buddha images, because he's a gardener. He's all retired, but he does gardening. He'd go to garden centres, and over the last decades, Buddha images you can buy for your garden. So in his house, he's got these Buddha images in his garden and on the mantelpiece and so on and so forth. We never have a discussion about Buddhism. He just likes the image. It's just there. It's just around. And I went to have lunch with my sister in the local garden centre, and there they were. Buddha images next to the Cupids and the angels and the dragons and so on and so forth. It's just there. The Buddha image is out there. I was with another friend a few weeks ago, and we were up late watching, I think it was something like Crime Scene Investigation or one of those American cop programs, a little weakness I have. You know, and some dreadful murder has happened in this apartment, and sure enough, part of the decor, there he is, the Buddha looking on. The Buddha is sort of around, and it's usually the seated sedent, you know, Buddha in the posture of meditation. So he's sort of well known. Another friend of mine, a Buddhist artist, was making a very, very large Buddha image for our shrine room, which is there now. And when he was making it, I think somebody had tried to break into his house, and the police came to have a look around. His studio is really quite extraordinary as well. It's just full of all sorts of things. And the policeman said, you're working on the Buddha. I know it's the Buddha because of the bump on his head. So I think this is really interesting that the Buddha is sort of known in this way in terms of sort of popular culture. He's sort of out there. He's sort of known. Of course, nobody really knows with these sort of sightings of the Buddha image, the whole sort of background to why you have a Buddha image. Some people, when they read about Buddhism, some books on Buddhism might even sort of say that, well, the Buddha wasn't a god, and of course he wasn't. He wasn't regarded as a creator god, but his followers made him into a god. And you see this with the Buddha image, and that's sort of regarded as a god that you pray to, and so on and so forth. And of course, it's not like that. And it's worthwhile, I think, just exploring, if we're going to look at the Buddha as the symbol of awakening, just exploring how the Buddha image emerges, how it emerges out of the experience, because that's where it emerges from, the experience of Buddhists, how it emerges from the life and example of the Buddha himself. So that's what I want to do a bit tonight. In some ways, I was thinking, I shouldn't have been thinking when I was meditating, but I was. What I'd really like to have done this evening, but it's not in my power. Rather than give a talk, I wish I had the sort of magic power, if you like, to evoke for you the presence of the Buddha. Then we'd understand so much about the Buddha as the symbol of awakening. You know, in a way we have to kind of imagine what it's like to sit in the presence of the enlightened one, of the awakened one. Because so often in the Buddhist texts, the records of the Buddha, that's what's really going on. Yes, you've got pages and pages of teaching and doctrine and wonderful teaching on how to live, how to practice Buddhism, how to gain enlightenment, and so on and so forth. But the context is of a human being communicating with other human beings. Yes, the Buddha is an enlightened human being, but there he is communicating, sometimes even communicating through complete silence, without any words at all. You get these wonderful stories in the life of the Buddha. There's a very famous one of a very, very violent king who'd killed his father, and to get to the throne, as often happened, it's not just in ancient India, all over the world. And he goes, his chief physician, who's a prominent disciple of the Buddha, they're talking about what they're going to do that night, which big teacher are they going to see, because the Buddha in his day was one among many famous teachers, gurus, if you like. And, you know, a good thing to do on a wonderful full moon night in India was to go off and, you know, sit with a teacher. Take darshan, as the traditional word. See and be seen by the teacher. Dwell in their presence. Maybe hear some advice. So Jivaka, the physician, says to King Ajatasattu in the court, look, the Buddha isn't far away. He's in the forest with 1,250 monks. Let's go and see him. Let's have an outing. So, you know, off they go. And I think, you know, elephants had to be saddled or whatever elephants are done to, and so on. And they go into the jungle, into the night, and it's absolutely silent. Wonderful full moon, stars spread over the sky, moving into this jungle, and there's not a sound. And Ajatasattu, as they go on, gets more and more frightened, because he wonders because he's paranoid, he's a paranoid despot. So he's really frightened that he's going to be betrayed, he's going to be ambushed, and he keeps asking Jivaka, are you leading me into a trap? Where are we going? I can't hear anything. I can't hear 1,250 people. And eventually they go on and they come to this clearing. The moon is full, and there they are. There's the Buddha, seated amid 1,250 of his disciples, in complete and utter silence. You could say they were meditating, but it's not like our mindfulness of breathing. It's beyond meditation, probably, as we know it. They're dwelling in what the Buddha called the Aryan silence, the noble silence, which is a silence of thought, as much as of words. And no doubt within that there is sort of waves of communication, but there being no need for words, just this enormous presence. I sort of imagine sometimes, you know, if you were around the Buddha, you'd just be in this enormous presence, this sort of vast consciousness. So there they all are, sitting in that silence. So I really would have liked to have done something like that this evening, so that you have a sense of this is a man who communicates beyond the words, the actual quality of enlightenment and awakening. And there's no need for explanation. There's no need to explain all that. But I can't do that, because that's all in the sort of books and texts of records of, you know, 2,500 years ago. But we have to keep that in mind, you know, when we're dwelling on the Buddha, that the Buddha communicates through his being, much more through his being and behavior, by what he was, rather than through his words. And elaborate explanations can often just be there to sort of fill our own insecurities, our own sort of anxieties about not being able to sort of just simply dwell in the presence of that vast silence and peace. And the meditating Buddha particularly communicates that. The Buddha with the mudra like this, the Dhyana mudra. That's a sort of symbol of the profound depths of the Buddha's silence. Of the deep, deep silence that he always has access to after his enlightenment. Of course, that came through enormous struggle, striving, effort to reach that kind of peace, that kind of depth of stillness and of meditation. And that's why when we meditate, it's best if you can put your hands in this sort of gesture. Obviously, you need to be comfortable, because you're actually sort of adopting the very posture of the Buddha. You're when you're meditating, you're in a way trying to sort of bring the Buddha alive in your experiences as you meditate. You know, traditionally, when you meditate in the Buddhist context, the first thing you'll do usually is to chant praises of the Buddha, which it's not so much praises, it's more like recollecting his qualities, recollecting the qualities of an enlightened, awakened being, so that you are put into the mood, into the gesture, into the space of enlightenment itself, so that this inspires your meditation. At the beginning, Dharmashali was talking about setting our motivation when we chanted the verses saluting the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Well, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to sort of evoke where we're going in our meditation, evoke where we're going. And it's towards that stillness and that silence evoked by the seated Buddha, the Buddha seated in meditation. Because it's out of that silence, out of the depth of that silence, that we awaken. It's out of that silence, that depth of silence, that the Buddha awakens. The word Buddha means one who has woken up. It can also be sort of translated or rendered as the enlightened one, because the Buddha didn't just use the metaphor of waking up from sleep and dream, a delusive sleep and dream, to talk about enlightenment. He talked about light shining, like the light at the end of a long, dark, troubled night. The light, the dawning of the light. That's another metaphor that he used, where everything is clearly seen. Before there was darkness, and in that darkness one was lost, just moving around, not knowing what one was doing, blundering along, and then there's light. And a very clear picture, a very clear vision of what is presented. So I want to talk about the metaphor, because the metaphor in a way is a symbol as well, of awakening, of the Buddha as the awakened one, of waking up from the sleep of ignorance. Ignorance, unknowing, avidya, moha. They've got these, I mean, even the words in sort of Sanskrit sound a bit heavy, don't they? Moha, which is like sort of delusion, confusion, avidya. Avidya is interesting because you could translate it as anti-wisdom. Vidya means knowledge or wisdom, special knowledge, if you like, knowledge of what is, seeing deeply into things. Is a negative prefix. So it's unknowing, and the implication is that it's a sort of willful unknowing. It's symbolized in Buddhist tradition generally of a blind man with a stick. In a way, that's not very good, I don't think, because it's better. At some point, one Buddhist writer said it would be better if it's more like a blindfolded man with a stick, and he's put the blindfold on. That's the point, and doesn't know it, and he's blundering along because of that. So I want to talk about ignorance, about unknowing, about waking up, and do my best to relate that to the Buddha as much as I can. What do we wake up from? What is this ignorance? What are we not seeing? What's actually in front of our faces all the time? Always present. This is very, very important in Buddhist tradition. Enlightenment is sometimes described as knowledge and vision of things as they really are. Yatta bhuta jnana darshana, if you want the Sanskrit, the linguists among you. knowledge and vision of things as they really are. It's not about adding information to our already full minds and consciousness. It's more about removing darkness, removing veils, to see what is there, what's happening all the time. This is very, very important. This is the sort of liberating seeing. So let's get down to something very, very basic. The Buddha very often started with what was basic in his own expositions of how we wake up. So the most obvious truth, if you like, to wake up to, which we cover over, is the absolutely ubiquitous, universal, constant sense or reality of impermanence, and change. Nothing is eternal. Wherever you look, you know, from the vastness of the galaxy right down to the sort of smallest detail of your body and mind, you won't find anything that resists the truth of impermanence and change. But it is something that we are constantly avoiding. We don't want to look at it. There's sort of good reasons for that, perhaps. It might be rather depressing to look into it, because one of the things we have to face up to when we look at impermanence is our own mortality and the mortality of our nearest and dearest. And we can often live a life of denial in relation to the fact of change. Sometimes it sort of pokes through. You know, those moments where there's a sort of loss in your life, or maybe you're suffering from illness or something like that after a time of health, or you lose somebody you love, you know, very, very deeply. And it pokes through, and for a moment you start asking questions of yourself and life. What is it for? What is it for if it ends like this? Or if we have a life-threatening illness or something like that? What am I doing? And of course, some people, they respond to that when they see. So Buddhist tradition, the Buddha himself, encourages us to look impermanence squarely in the eye. It's nothing to be frightened of, actually. It can seem very fearful, but actually it's much better to look at it. You have to look at it with very, very kindly eyes, with a lot of loving kindness, if you've done that meditation, a lot of mindfulness and awareness, a lot of support, if you like, from spiritual friends. But we have to look, because it is there. And it's very interesting to see the way in which the Buddha, you know, some of the things he says about what happens when you really embrace the impermanence of things. There's one particular verse that I really ought to meditate on it much more than I do. It's only a few lines. It's in the very first chapter of the Dhammapada. It's quite difficult to translate. It goes something like, others do not realize that we're all heading for death. Those who do realize it will end their quarrels. Others do not realize that we're all headed for death. Those who do realize it will end their quarrels or compose their quarrels. When I first heard that, I heard it in a slightly different version. It was more like, people don't realize that we're all headed for death. Those who do realize it will stop quarreling with other people. When I heard that, and it was quite a few years after I'd been ordained, I knew that the Buddha was enlightened. I thought that's such a simple, direct, meaningful statement, truth, connecting mortality, awareness of mortality, waking up to that truth, to human communication, to human connection, to love, actually, to friendliness, to being in harmony with others. And when I first heard it, it was our teacher, Sangharakshita. It was actually in India when we were marking the passing, the sudden passing, it can often happen like that in India, of a very good friend of ours. And a few months later, we had what's known as the Punyana Modana, the rejoicing in his merits. And Sangha Achta, our teacher, gave a discourse just on this verse. And he went into it a bit more. He sort of unpacked it and said, well, it's like this, isn't it? Supposing you have a row, a falling out with a loved one, a friend, a family member, and then they die. You've got no way of resolving that situation. They've gone. Okay, you can do work on yourself. Of course you can. You can transcend those circumstances. But with that person, that other precious human being, you can't do that. They've gone. And of course, if you go, well, according to Buddhist tradition, you don't go into nothingness. You get reborn. You're unresolved. There's something unresolved before you head off. The other side of this is that if you're not going to get into quarreling, you have to do the opposite. You really have to develop metta and loving kindness constantly and continually. So making that connection between change, impermanence, mortality and love, for me was an awakening, if you like, a waking up moment. And I felt tremendous confidence in the Buddha's teaching. No elaborate philosophy, no complicated metaphysics, just a simple, direct statement about what happens on a very, very human level, on a very, very basic level. There's also something else to do with impermanence and waking up to it. Of course, it's said that if you really see impermanence, the fact that everything is changing all the time, you enter the stream. You enter the stream that just flows in the direction of enlightenment, the stream that just flows in the direction of the fullness of wisdom and compassion. When you really see it, we tend to think of impermanence and change in terms of loss. In a way, that's the way I've been talking about it, that we're going to lose something. But change works in another way. It's not just about loss, it's also about gaining. The fact of impermanence, the fact of change guarantees the possibility of continual transformation. If there wasn't change, we couldn't change, if you see what I mean. We couldn't do the mindfulness of breathing and move from a scattered state to a concentrated state. If there wasn't change, that wouldn't be possible. We'd be fixed in the scattered state. If there wasn't change, we wouldn't be able to change hatred into love. That wouldn't be possible. We would not be able to compose our quarrels with others. So change is liberating. Change is liberating if we can see it in the right kind of way, if we can see it with perfect vision, if we can see it from that deep stillness symbolized by the Buddha's hands in meditation. Impermanence is known as the first mark of this world, of this life. There's a second mark that the Buddha pointed to, and this is unsatisfactoriness. So this is another thing that we don't really want to sort of wake up to. We don't want to sort of own. It's called dukkha in Sanskrit. The fact, it's often translated simply as suffering. And again, some of you might, in your reading, have come across Buddhist texts that say, the Buddha says, all life is suffering. I mean, when I first came across that, I thought, I don't want to be a Buddhist. I want bliss. I want ecstasy. Why would I want to be involved in a religion that is going on about suffering all the time? It's the last thing I want. I still have difficulties with this teaching, by the way. So I prefer teachings where the Buddha says, Nibbanam Paramam Sukham. Nirvana is the supreme bliss. Yes, enlightenment is bliss, enlightenment is ecstasy. Very important to remember that, keep that in mind as I go into talking about this business of dukkha and unsatisfactoriness. We don't have to look very far in our own experience and you know, across the world to see how much pain and suffering there is. It's absolutely overwhelming. That doesn't mean that we've woken up to the mark of dukkha. It doesn't mean that we're seeing that with perfect wisdom. It's not as if, doesn't mean we're seeing things as they are. In fact, I think the dukkha industry, the pain industry or the catastrophe industry, and I mean the media, 24-hour rolling news, where you're just presented with disaster after disaster, epidemics, environmental catastrophe, terrorist attacks, etc., 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 all over the world, which you can do nothing about. There's something about that that I think actually prevents really seeing dukkha, really seeing unsatisfactoriness. Because it doesn't just mean pain or suffering. It means more like waking up to the fact that things aren't as they should be. It might even be that your life is actually going quite well. Things are moving along quite well. One of the ways you can translate dukkha is the faulty chariot wheel. You know, imagine you're going on in a chariot in ancient India, or a bullock cart, even more uncomfortable. And one of the wheels is off. So there's this constant sort of juddering. There's this constant sense that things aren't right. Even though you might be well fed, well clothed, well housed, wonderful family, good career, good job, and all the rest of it. There's something not quite right. There's a kind of ache, a kind of longing, a kind of, something's not working. And very often if you start talking about this to people, they can say, well, why don't you go to the doctor and get some pills, you know, go and have therapy. You know, something like that. That may work. That maybe that's all that is needed. But, you know, we know there's a lot of depression around these days, and, you know, that there's a lot of responses to that. I tend to think that the real crisis is the crisis of meaning. That the reason, those feelings of unsatisfactoriness is because there's a deep longing for something else. The Buddha would say it's actually a deep longing for enlightenment itself. That there's something in human beings. Something in human beings that can only be satisfied by moving in the direction of greater awareness, greater wisdom, greater love, greater understanding, greater connection. There's something in us that absolutely longs for that kind of fulfillment. And until we feel we're on that path and making substantial progress, we won't feel that satisfaction. Very often ignorance is about denying that sort of feeling, denying that kind of response. It was one of the reasons why the Buddha got going on his quest, you know, before he was the Buddha, before he was the enlightened one, when he was a young prince in his palace. There was this tremendous sense of, being stifled. You have to remember it's the Indian extended family. His destiny is to, he's from a Kshatriya community, his destiny is to become the next king, the next Raja, the next leader of his community. And in an early, very, very old Buddhist text, which probably reflects the words of the Buddha himself, you get this incredible saying, in very, very vivid language. He says, cramped is this life at home, dusty indeed its sphere. So open up the going forth. When you go forth, when you leave home, you live out under the open. And it's not just a literal living out under the open. It's a symbol of a different life, of a life. So it's relevant to all of us. We don't literally have to, you know, leave home. But we do need to kind of leave that sense of being cramped, that unsatisfactoriness of being restricted. You can feel sometimes your consciousness, your mind, your being, just wanting to break free, wanting to break out, wanting that more open-ended kind of life, which isn't, you know, living selfishly or something like that. Wanting to, you know, express a greater awareness, a greater love, and so on. So, when the Buddha wakes up, he sees that, he lays that bare, he lays that unsatisfactoriness bare, and he lives this much, much more open life. I'll come back to that in a moment about the open life in relation to others, because it's also related to the Buddha's compassion And finally, the other mark that the Buddha reveals through his enlightenment is, this can be a problematic one, is the fact that there is nothing in life which has any kind of permanent substance. This is sometimes called the doctrine of no self, which can be really misunderstood. You know, that we can be told or feel sometimes when we're reading books on Buddhism that, oh, I don't have a self. Well, most palpably you do have a self. You know, it's more that there isn't any kind of permanent, fixed, unchanging essence that is you until the end of this life. You won't be able to find that. You won't be able to locate that. And I think we can get glimpses of it, of that that sense of not self. You ever have those moments when you're standing in a shopping mall, if you ever go into those places, and suddenly there is this terrible feeling of unreality? Ever had that? Is that just me? You know, suddenly everything starts to kind of get very, very insubstantial and weird. And you feel, hang on, there's nothing here. You know, it's all surface. I mean, very, very sort of pretty in a way. But it's just surface. There's nothing here. You kind of, how did I get here? Why am I here? What am I doing here? I used to often experience it at Alicante Airport after a four-month retreat up in the mountains in Spain, where we'd been doing lots of meditation and developing lots of loving kindness for all beings and so on and so forth. And then we'd come out of our mountain retreat, go into Alicante Airport, and you're sort of getting on your plane, standing in a queue of holidaymakers from Benidorm, and this weird unreality. And I have to say also in my case, the terrible confession, I'm not proud of this, an overwhelming sort of misanthropy. I think this is absolutely disgusting, you know. And then I have to remind myself, hang on a minute, you know, these are all the people you've been developing loving kindness for. But this terrible sense of lack of meaning. And you kind of look at people, people don't look happy. I don't know, because they're going home or the holiday hasn't worked. They're all a bit red. But there's this terrible feeling of unreality, of sort of emptiness. Actually, those moments can be very frightening. And again, we can sort of, it's solid, it's substantial. Everything is really here. Let's go and have a drink and a burger or something. Get over to Burger King as fast as we can. No, actually, these things are signs. You know, they're communicating something. You're getting a glimpse into this sort of hollowness. Doesn't actually need to be like this. This sense of the sort of insubstantiality can actually be really liberating. It doesn't have to be seen as something unpleasant. It's more that when things are unsubstantial, where Buddhist tradition sometimes uses, later Buddhist tradition, the language of maya, which means illusion. But it's seen as something sort of, actually everything is like a wonderful sort of work of art. It's a wonderful sort of display. Very vivid, very, very bright. Like sort of rainbows coming and going. And you can relate to it entirely differently, in a completely free way. Not in a way that sort of horrifies you. In a way that sort of liberates you and frees you up to engage more creatively with what's going on, rather than in this very fixed way. So the Buddha, when he sees things as they are, when he kind of removes the veil of ignorance, he lays these things bare. And it completely changes his response to things. I've tried to sort of indicate, you know, what that might look like with his awakening, and also tried to sort of show how we might see these points in our own experience where this might arise. But I want to end, I really should start winding up now, by saying something about the Buddha's compassion. And actually, it's very useful that we have these two images here, because, and what's interesting, these are kind of, I won't say they're non-traditional, but they are creations of Western artists, order member artists. This one, obviously, is the Buddha. It's a form of the Buddha. But it's actually based on a vision of our teacher, a vision of the Buddha, of Red Buddha in this case, holding up a lotus. It's quite unusual. You don't often see this form. And this painting, this more sort of lifelike painting, is a depiction of the Buddha and his very close friend and attendant, Ananda. The last 20 years, I think, of the Buddha's life, maybe longer, they were sort of constant companions. And this is this particular order member's sort of real, you know, attempt to try and communicate this. So I want to just talk about these two images, because they actually do complement each other quite a lot. I've talked about the Buddha's meditation, seated in deep stillness. I've tried to say something about him seeing things as they really are, seeing deeply into the nature of things and how that might apply to us. In the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, there's all sorts of experiences that he undergoes. But one of them is quite interesting. He was considering communicating what he'd seen, because he knew it was liberating. I mentioned that enlightenment is great bliss. In some of the texts, it describes him sitting for 7 days and seven nights, multiples of 7 days and seven nights, in one posture, experiencing the vimoksha sukha, the bliss of liberation. This is really important to get hold of. If you really want bliss, if you really want ecstasy, enlightenment, awakening is the path you need to follow. Absolutely indestructible bliss and satisfaction. That's why I do it, you know. Why would you do it for anything else? No pills involved, you know, just entirely through realization. But he considered how do I make this known? Who can I make it known to? And he thought, no. He sort of thought about the world, other people, and how crude everybody is, if you like, how, you know, dull we are. And he was inclined not to communicate. A very, very interesting moment. And hard to understand, really. One of the ways I understand it is that he's reached a point in his unfolding. Dharmashalin was getting at this earlier, that is so beyond any language, any ideas, any known experience. It's far too subtle, profound, deep, to actually make known to others. And to make it known would be just hard work. You know, why bother? Why not just enjoy that bliss alone? But various things happened and he looked again, and it's very interesting what he sees. So instead of just seeing dukkha and impermanence and insubstantiality, these things, you know, universal change and all the rest of it, he has another vision, which actually he obviously finds very difficult to articulate. It's a vision of living beings, of us, of human beings, all life. And all he can use is a metaphor. And it's a very, very beautiful metaphor. It's, you've probably heard it many times, but it's a vision of human beings, as being like a vast lake of lotus flowers, red and white and blue, growing in a vast lake. Some are tight buds in the mud and tangle of the swamp. Others are pushing up out of the water into the sunlight. Others are really opening. I don't know if you've ever been to countries where you see lotuses. I mean, having spent a bit of time in India, lotuses seem to really love the most sort of thick, black, stinky ponds. And they are amazing. They are absolutely amazing. They kind of thrust up. And they are kind of luminous. Luminous pink or red. Very, very sort of powerful, even though they're very delicate and soft. And they seem to just love these very dark places which they arise from. So this is the Buddha's vision of life, of living beings. And it's said that at that time, his compassion was sort of activated. So it's very interesting that when we think about this word compassion, which I don't particularly like, because I think it can be far too easily confused with pity and sort of feeling sorrowful at the world. It's not really that. It's a lovely word in Pali and Sanskrit, which is often translated as compassion. It's anukampa, which literally means to shake with. So what's really going on with the Buddha's vision? His full awakening, if you like, his full wisdom and compassion and bliss and liberation is shaking with, resonating with that potential in all of us. Because there's something absolutely essential to being human that wants to emerge, that wants to open. Sometimes say that, you know, Buddhism isn't a sort of luxury thing. It's absolutely essential because it's about what human beings do. Perhaps even, you don't even have to call it Buddhism, but there's something that wants to unfold, like lotuses out of a really muddy lake. That is what the Buddha's compassion really is. It's this desire to communicate, to show, to tell, to make known this liberating path, to give people the ways, the methods, whereby they can transform, where they can move in the direction of that full bliss, that full liberation. So one of the ways I see this image, and there's lots of ways you can, it's a symbol, so there's lots of ways you can interpret it. What the Buddha is doing in holding up that lotus, he's showing us what we can become, what we can be. We can unfold into that very still, very steady, very silent, very present image, if you like, being, that enlightened being, through following that path of the lotus, that unfolding. But it's really important that you've got this, because the Buddha is, well, they're obviously going somewhere, aren't they? They're walking somewhere. They've just sort of stopped on the way. And it's the Buddha as an old man. And the Buddha kept, this is the really interesting thing about the Buddha, that yes, after his enlightenment, he did stay in retreat from time to time, particularly in the rainy season, with his disciples, meditating, teaching, and so on. But for most of the year, he was walking. He was wandering. He was going from place to place, even when he was an old, sick man, with back problems and dysentery and all the rest of it, he kept communicating. Sometimes people ask, why did the Buddha die or enter what's known as Parinirvana in an obscure village? Because that's where he did pass away, Kushinagara in northern India. Well, it's obvious, because he wanted to communicate what he'd seen to people who'd never heard it before. And he'd communicate with everybody and anybody, the high, the so-called low. He made no distinction. All he would see in people was their potential for enlightenment. Men, women, business people, kings, playboys, children. If the Buddha were to walk into this room now, he'd see us, but he'd be completely tuned up to our spiritual potential. That's what he would be in touch with. That's what he would be in tune with. He'd know that. He'd see it directly. It wouldn't be an idea. He'd just know intuitively what we would need to move along the path. Of course, it's up to us whether or not we follow. I mean, there are many stories in the Buddhist texts where the Buddha gives a fantastic teaching, and somebody listening says, yeah, maybe. And they walk away, which I think is really important. I'm really glad that's there, because it's entirely our decision whether we follow that path of awakening in the presence of the Buddha, the symbol of awakening.